For those of you that haven't met me, my name is Don Coberly. I've been here for the last about 5 weeks working. I work for a company called Dames & Moore. We are an engineering consulting firm that has been hired by Alumet, who is the company that owns Howe Sound Mining,
indirectly,
who are the people who did the mining here. I have been working on this meeting for at least the last 15 or 20 minutes, so if I, if I appear or sound nervous, it's because I'm nervous. I put together a brief outline or itinerary for the report, starting with the project history, looking at certain site conditions and concerns, a description of the field program that we have been running currently, a discussion of the preliminary results. I underline that word preliminary because as I talked to you about 5 weeks ago when I got here, we're very early in the process of the investigation. We have been collecting samples. Those samples have been sent to a lab, and we don't have those results back yet. The last thing we will do is we will try to answer whatever questions we can. The other people who will be speaking this evening, Steve Arnett, who is another one of the people that's been here the last 5 weeks, and Rick Longendoon, who is the
assistant project manager.
From Dames & Moore in Seattle. He's currently the highest ranking person we have here, so all really tough questions should be directed to him.
And we'll talk later on.
You're fired.
Good. So.
Did you saw another blast?
Yeah.
So with that, I will turn things over to Rick, who will talk about the project history since he's been involved longer than either Steve or I have.
Actually, I'm trying to get an idea of who the audience, we have for an audience this evening. How many people are long-term residents here at Home Depot? A lot. And how many people are just visiting for a week or less? Or
There's summer staff, don't forget us.
Oh, summer staff. So how long, summer staff are here for how long?
Oh, anywhere from 3 weeks to 2 months. Yeah.
The reason why I'm asking is that maybe I should just give you a real quick thumbnail sketch of the history of the mine. A lot of us end up getting our first introduction coming up on the Lady of the Lake and a little spiel we get right when we get to Lucerne about the mine. Just real briefly, this area was explored back in the late 1800s, and the reason why this town is called Holden, because a person by the name of J.R. Holden came in. He was part of a geographic survey, and he came in, and he was also a geologist in the mining field, and he came up this valley and saw what he thought to be a lode, and came back some years later and followed up with it and discovered there was some mining potential here. And that happened in the 1800s, and then through the early 1900s, and through the 20s, there were several companies that tried to develop the mine. And finally, in about early 1930s, a company by the name of Howe Sound out of Canada finally got some money behind it and decided to start developing it. And they put in the road, they put in you may have read or heard about the railway they tried to put in down below. They put in a power transmission line. And they drove in a number of the first major explorations into the main ore body. And just to give you a little idea, and I don't want to get too much detail, I think to me it's really interesting, but I'm a geologist, so. if you look at Up Valley, and Holden is here, and here's River Creek, and Bonanza's up in this area here.
Ken isn't working.
Here's a good marker.
From what we know of the geology, the ore body is basically sitting, you have a whole number of beds of geologic units. They're sitting kind of roughly in that orientation. And what you have, if you look up the hillside, you have that main tunnel going in, that portal. And the ore body is in one of these areas. Again, this is very simplified. And they basically then started mining this out. and bring this out. And also, the first thing they did, though, is up in the Honeymoon Heights area, you see, for those of you, have you walked, anybody walked up to Honeymoon Heights? If you walked there, you saw the big piles, the waste rock piles, and there's some adits, some old tunnels, adits they had up there. And what they did is they first accessed it up here, but when they started to develop, when they looked at developing the mine, they realized they wanted to put the mill here, run a gravity feed system. So they ran a, this main portal runs back about almost a half a mile back, intercepts this ore body. So that happened back in, I think the approval, they got the permit in 1937, 1938, and started developing the mine. So during that period of time, they pulled out primarily copper, some zinc, and also some gold. And what they ended up doing is they processed that ore. They brought it up, processed it through the mill facility. And what you see out here, the tails are the remainder of the ground up the ore. They went through the processing, and then what they ended up, what remained of it being a slurry, they ended up being pumped first out to tailings pile number one, the nearest one to the mill, then subsequently to tailings pile number two and three. And that happened over a period of time of 20 years. The other product that was generated was the waste rock piles you see up near the portal, and that's rock that, from the perspective of the miners at the time, didn't have enough concentration of ore to warrant going through the processing. So that was dumped in those two main piles, which again are similar to what you see up in Honeymoon Heights. So that went through that process, and then in 1958, the copper prices dropped. The machinery is getting a little bit old, and they finally decided to go ahead and close down the operation. 1960, and I think a number of you probably know this story better than I, and that is there's a party from one person from the Lutheran Church who contacted Howe Sound Company, who had put the mine onto the market, couldn't sell it, and asked for, and basically to give it to the church, and as through, if you go up to the Portal Museum, you'll see the letters that went from the person from the Lutheran Church and then the response. And basically, the long story is in 1960, it was deeded over to the Lutheran Church, and Holden Village was formed in 1961. And I should restate that the look at the ownership of the property, there are a number of patented claims that Howe Sound had. Two claims right where the mill area is, and then a number of 13 claims that run parallel to that ore body, running along the slope of that ore body. But all the property was owned by the U.S. Forest Service and still remains with the U.S. Forest Service. So when everything was deeded over to Holden Village, the Forest Service still retained the property. So at that point, Howe Sound was no more, and the Forest Service decided to follow through with addressing some concerns that they started to recognize that they had. The main ones that you probably see are the steep slopes along the creek, and they also started noting this problem of this, what they call acid rock drainage, which is the tailings contain sulfide type rocks that mix with water and form a lower pH water that then flows through the tails and leaches out some of the metals that are in the tails. And so the Forest Service started doing a number of studies over the last 30 years. And a lot of work was done. For those of you who walked on top of the tails, you've probably seen a number of these metal pipes standing out of the top of the tailings piles. Well, in the late 1980s, there were about 65 or 70 of these wells that were drilled by Pacific Northwest Laboratories out of Richland. And they were trying to find out what the chemistry of the water was. There were a number of environmental studies done in the creek. There were a number of studies done around in the soils, and looking at also the idea of maybe reprocessing the mine tails to look at possible to get rid of the problem that they had, as well as get some kind of profit. And I think the village was involved with some of that historically. Bureau of Mines completed some studies as well. And then Alumet Incorporated, who again is kind of indirectly involved, they have nothing to do with mining, but they had inherited some of the ownership of Howe Sound through some of the purchases that they had made. And at that point, Forest Service had contacted Alumet, and we ended up then getting involved as a representative for Alumet to help study to see what problems exist here at the site. So our first task that we completed was actually to try to compile all the historical data that had been developed or generated over the last 35 years or so. So that was our first task. We completed that last year. We generated a report that was submitted then to the Forest Service that identified a number of still some gaps in the data for us to proceed to look at what remedial options do we have. And the primary ones are pretty easy to identify. We had problems with not consistent data with groundwater, inconsistent data with surface water that was collected. And we didn't have an adequate level of study in the stream itself. So Alumet has been then, over the last year, has been negotiating with the Washington State Department of Ecology, US EPA, and the Forest Service to come up with what we call basically an agreed order to proceed then, even though it's not a Superfund site, we're treating it as a study as if it's almost a Superfund site. And we're studying the site now to come up with a list of remedial options that we can then proceed. So what we're doing now, I'll pass on to Don in a moment, but we're basically trying to fill those gaps over the next year, develop the remedial options, and then proceed through the remediation phase. And what I'd like to just reiterate before we get too far along is that the relationship between Alumet and the agencies isn't an antagonistic relationship, which is normally the case quite often on these sites. And we aren't operating under any kind of agreed order at this point, which is why, for those of you that live here, you haven't heard that there hasn't been any kind of public involvement yet. Normally a project of this size would have some kind of public involvement. We haven't signed an agreed order, and I'm hoping that I'm not even out of place by doing this today, but I think it's our responsibility to let you know what we're doing. But I just wanted to emphasize that over the next month, once the agreed order is signed, the Forest Service has a contractor on board that will be completing a public involvement task. And you as Holden Village and other parties that are interested will be allowed the opportunity to provide input into this job and where we're going from here. But just that we're just trying to give you information. We're not trying to hide anything. We just want to be upfront with you that you will be more involved as time goes on. And this is more of an information tonight. So I'll pass on to Don, who's going to kind of go over what you've been doing over the last month. And then I can emphasize where we're going from here.
And one of the reasons that we sort of split up what we're going to talk about is so that each one of us can kind of make up what we're going to talk about next as the other person is talking. So, I was originally going to call this Site Hydrogeology and Geochemistry.
Thank you.
And I thought maybe that would have been a way to cut down the number of people.
Right.
But I do want to pass along just a little basic science so that hopefully in the future, I hope what will happen is that you will become sort of better consumers of whatever it is that we're doing. Hopefully you'll get involved to the point where you can say, yeah, that sounds right, or no, that doesn't sound right. And so that I see part of what we're doing as informing, and sometimes you have to step back a little bit. So to go to basic hydrogeology, which is the way water flows, all surface water and most groundwater flows downhill. That's the end of the hydrogeology lesson. But it's important in this area. There are certain instances where groundwater will come out higher in an area. But for these purposes, I think the basic rule applies. So what that means is that everything that comes down out of this drainage, either good water or mine water or some other kind of water, all comes to one place, which is Railroad Creek. And it goes down Railroad Creek and winds up in Lake Chelan. So that's the sort of picture that we came into the area with, is that we've got a sort of a closed bowl here or a bathtub with one drain in it. And everything that comes out goes in the drain. So, that's hydrogeology. Geochemistry will be equally complex. With this being a mine site, there are certain things that we're worried about and there are certain things that we're not worried about. I spent a year working at the Texaco refinery in Casper, Wyoming, The problem there is that they've got a bunch of gasoline they spilled in the ground. That isn't the problem here. Problems here are related to the mining that went on. And as Rick talked about a little bit, all of the ore minerals, this is the chemical formula. That sulfur, when it reacts with water and oxygen, generates sulfuric acid, which is the thing that then continues to leach further. So it's sort of a self-compounding problem. And when these minerals were back inside the mountain, there was some of this, but there was very little of this. When it was brought out to the surface, now the rest of the stuff is there for the reaction to continue. And the other thing that comes off is now that this sulfur is being used for something else, now this copper is free and free into the environment. It's the same thing that happens with zinc. It's the same thing that happens with lead. So, and it's those things that metal in free into the environment that's problematic. Too much metal in the water is bad for you. That's the bottom line. Too much metal in the water is bad for fish, too. So that's half the problem. The other half of the problem is this acid rock drainage that Rick talked about. And the way that that is measured is through measuring the pH of the water. Now, does everybody know a little bit about what pH is about? pH 7 water is neutral water. pH greater than 7 is 2 alkaline. pH less than 7 becomes acidic. So the things that we did as far as looking at the chemistry is we're concerned with the amount of acid in the water, and we're concerned about the amount of metal in the water. So that's hydrogeology and geochemistry. Which leads into a little bit about the work that we have done over the last month. One of the data gaps that we had identified previously, there, as Rick said, there's been a lot of work done here. A lot of work that I'm familiar with is done by a guy named Jim Kilburn, who was the guy who was here about 3 weeks ago, kind of the tanned, silver-haired guy who's been here 3 or 4 or 5 times. He works for the U.S. Geological Survey out of Denver, Colorado. Evan, I don't know how he got here originally, other than to get away for a while to a really nice place. And then he went out and did some sampling so that he could justify coming back 3 or 4 more times.
Just like us.
Exactly. And he has published a number of papers that are available in the library. If you would like to read them, they're interesting to a small, disturbed part of it. But some of the conclusions that he came to were that there is water here that is of relatively poor quality. That's a given. What we had seen as a weakness in that work is that how much bad water is there? So the one of the major things that we have tried to focus on is what is the load of metal that comes into Railroad Creek from different sources. There's a portal drainage that comes out and drains right into the river. We look at that and we sort of assume it, we try to imagine it as a load where for a certain amount of time all of that water that comes out of the portal drainage goes into a bathtub and just stays there and evaporates off, and behind is some residue of zinc, and that's the zinc load. So we can imagine that there would be some of these seeps that we have seen that have admittedly poor water quality, high acid, high metals, but they flow at very low rates. So therefore, if you put a bathtub under it and caught it, over that same period of time, maybe the amount of material you would have left behind would be smaller. So that's sort of the orientation that we came in with, was let's find out what the load is to Railroad Creek. and let's find out where the big loads come from. And when we go to devising remedial alternatives, let's not spend all of our money and efforts on cleaning up little piles. Let's get the big piles. So that's all of the field work that we have been doing has been related to let's find out where those major contributions to the river are.
Yeah, actually, to use your analogy, then take it one step further on the bathtub. I always use the bathtub full of marbles, which is basically this valley. You can even imagine instead of the, it works. I mean, it's glacial geomorphology, as we call it. Even with Don was saying about the bathtub, you can envision it even more where you open up the drain, and now you're putting in an input of a huge hose of water, and then you're adding maybe a couple drops of something, let's say a watercolor, whatever it is. But if you're not adding enough to it, you never see the response, because that water is constantly being flushed through the system, and that's what we're finding here, and that's what Don is saying. If you had a big source of coming in, a single source, would be one thing, but we're trying to find out what do we have accumulated of all these different sources, and are they significant? Because one thing we do know historically from all the data that's been collected is that the water quality of Railroad Creek is overall really good. Even with all these potential sources here, it's overall really good. But we obviously see some adverse impact. We see the cementation above the creek, and we see that there aren't any fish here. So what's causing that? And that's one of some of the questions that we're trying to answer. I'm sort of take away.
Not at all. Thank you, more. Again, that's what we were tasked to do. This is the second of four field operations that we will have. And so there were a number of sort of subtasks involved in trying to evaluate where those loads were coming from. With Railroad Creek being sort of the receptor of all this, one of the things that we're most concerned about is the water chemistry of the creek and an investigation of flow in the creek. And Steve's going to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Rick and Don know all about this, but they just want to put me in the spotlight for a little bit. So a lot of you folks have probably seen Pete and I out on the bridges, scratching up the railings, dragging the bridge board down there. And what we're doing is we were working, and we're measuring flow in the creek. This is a cross-section of Railroad Creek. We'd collect a water sample for submittal to the lab. That'll tell us concentrations of the analytes.
Actually, why don't you explain how you collect that sample as well?
Okay. We've got a... I let Pete do it. Most important. We've got a rod, called the depth integrated sampler, which is like a very fancy name for what is in essence a rod with a handle on it. And there's a little bottle that locks in on the end, and you just raise it up and down in a water column to sample the entire water.
It had a small nozzle so that as the water sample, what you're trying to do is collect as much as a representative sample across the creek. Because we wanted to know if there's water coming in and any of these sources into the creek. We want to make sure we're not skewing the results. So the intent was to take this sampler and drop it down and lift it up and drop it down, lift it up across the creek so that we're getting a good representative sample. And this sampler had like this pin, had a small nozzle in it. As you're dropping it down, little bits of water came into the bottom, the jar filled up.
We need more props, really. So having done that, then ideally during the same day, and always during the same day, we would take a discharge measurement at the Portal Footbridge up here and also at Sven's Bridge further down the creek. And what that involves is we divide the river into basically like 2-foot sections. Oh, we do have our one prop over here. We stretch a tape across the river, a measuring tape across the bridge, and we borrow a bridge board from the Forest Service. And this is a flow meter which measures velocity in feet per second. And we lower this on a large lead weight called a bomb to the bottom of the creek, and that cable distance is given to us by a little dial on the bridge board, so we know the depth and we know the width from the side of the creek. And as we go along, we record the depth and width, always 2 foot interval and depth. So we get area and velocity, and we can hit cubic feet per second from that.
Wow.
So, and then we just add up all the subsections, so then we know our flow, and we've got our concentrations from our laboratory results, and we know loading to the river, or the river's load at that time. And there you have it, discharge in a nutshell.
Yeah, that helps me remember something I forgot to tell you before, which is, how do we devise this load? How do we assess that? Well, load is based on a flow and a concentration, right? It's the amount of water flowing into the bathtub, and it's the quality of the water. And both of those are the, like I said, you can have a large flow, but if it's very clean water, you'll have a small load. If you have a little bit of really bad water, it may still be a small load. So those are the two key elements that we needed are, what's the concentration of the water? And we do that by sampling the water and putting it in a bottle and sending it off to the lab. And the lab does analytical techniques to the water, and they tell us you have X amount of copper in this water. We have to come up with some way of analyzing the flow. For surface water, it's fairly straightforward. The second part of the investigation was of the seeps, which are just small areas where water flows naturally out of the rock. This is again was we did an investigation, and there are a lot of seeps. If you've walked across on the other side of the tailings pile, there are certain areas where water sort of issues out from cracks in the rock or from beneath piles of boulders or things like that. So, again, Jim Kilburn is the one who has sort of led the investigation there previously. So he was out to work with us to make sure that we found the same seeps that he did, to look at our sampling protocol. And again, the one thing that he had never done before was try to associate a discharge, an amount of flow, with those samples that he had taken. It was surprising to me to talk to him and to see a couple of the seeps that he talked about, and I said, well, how did you sample these? And he said, well, with a syringe. And so that sort of helps to put things in scale, where up at the portal drainage, you have a drainage that's flowing very clearly, and you can see it, and the water's that deep and that wide, and it's flowing pretty fast. And then there are these seep areas, some of which are flowing at an order of sort of drops per day. So we visited all of the locations that Jim had seen previously, collected samples. Those are going to the lab. We are hoping that we will be able to confirm the data that he has collected previously and add the discharge calculations that we made and come up with the loads that come from the seeps.
And basically, what we end up generating is a large map. Map to be able to look at from the aerial, saying here are the primary areas of loading. So that focuses our effort on what we end up doing to try to take care of the problem.
The third project that we were involved in was looking at the groundwater, primarily on the tailings piles. And there are, as Rick said, 60 or 70 wells. We sampled 34 of them. We sampled a well back behind the chalets here to see what the influent groundwater chemistry is like, and to assess, again, what is the load that comes off the tailings pile. Now, the second thing, as I said, that we need to do to figure out the load coming off the tailings pile is what is the flow that comes into the creek off of that entire length. And flow in groundwater is dependent primarily upon two things. One is sort of the contour of the water table. What is the driving head? How much force is there behind trying to push water through the material? And the second thing is, what is the permeability of the material? How well does it transmit water? if we took a pile of boulders or rocks right here and poured a bucket of water in on top, it would come running out everywhere. If we did that same thing on a block of concrete, it would all run off the top. None of it would flow through the material. So the more permeable that material is, the faster and more easily it will transmit water. The way that we tested that is with a thing called a slug test. And part of the reason that we're talking about some of this is because we know that you've overheard some of our conversations at the table. And we don't want anyone to be confused about what a slug test is. Or any of these other sort of jargony terms that we use. We realize when we're talking amongst ourselves that we have our own sort of code, almost like Waitry and that to some people who aren't real familiar with it, they go, well, I wonder what they're talking about. So, and if at any point we get into that, all you got to do is raise your hand and sort of bring us back out a little bit, and we can try and explain it a different way. Anyway, these slug tests we did to try and evaluate the permeability of the material that makes up the tailings piles. And I bring in the slug, but it's a big, tall piece of PVC that wouldn't fit through the door very well. This is a schematic of a groundwater well. This is the well that's drilled down into the material, and there may be different layers of coarse and fine material. There is a water level associated with that well that represents the water table of the formation. What we do with the slug is a big plastic tube that's filled and ended at both ends, and we drop it into the well on a rope so that we can fish it back out. And what it does is it immediately sort of raises the water level in the well. It takes up space and pushes the water out. And how quickly that water sort of dissipates back out is indicative of how permeable the formation is. If that slug drops in and the water comes up and flows right back out, then it's a very permeable formation. If that slug drops in and the water level comes up and stays there for 2 or 3 days and drops off very slowly, that's a very impermeable formation. We will use those data to try and assess the load from the tailings pond. What's the water chemistry, because we get a sample out of this well, and how fast is water flowing through the tailings pile? It's somewhat analogous to the discharge measurement that Steve talked about. And instead of that cross-section being completely full, or completely empty, rather, here's Steve's cross-section of Railroad Creek.
Can't see it.
That's Steve's cross-section of Railroad Creek. I look at the tailings piles as being exactly the same way, except the cross-section is filled in with sand and tailings. And now the water is flowing out at us from the tailings pile. So I've just got more dirt in my cross-section than Steve does. So the last phase of the current field work is the geophysics that has been going on for about the last week, and I'll let Rick talk about that.
So we're trying to answer the surface water, the seep, and the groundwater, and the next question we're trying to answer is trying to figure out what the depth is to the bottom of the bathtub. Because we don't really know what the bottom of the bathtub is yet, because the wells have been all drilled so far. Going back to our basic geology, we're back to the village in Israel Creek. We generally know that the site is underlain by soil, and that's related to glaciation, those of you, I don't know, did anybody attend the meeting, the talk day about the glacial geology? You may have talked about the fact you have a classic U-shaped valley, and the reason why you have that is because your glacier came in and carved out the material. What you have normally exposed here in the side slopes is relative shell bedrock. And then as the glacier pulls out, it dumps a load of gravels in the bottom of the creek. And this material goes up a slope depending on where you are and what the glacier was doing. And the wells, if you look at them, the tails, are sitting somewhere on top of that. That's the tailings material. And the wells were drilled either into this material or above, into this tails. They were trying to figure out the water levels within the tails as well as the water level down below. And this material, from what we know, is either sitting a compact, ever heard of the term glacial till? Mm-hmm. It's a really hard, compact material. What we're finding is that what we sort of suspect based on the glacial geomorphology, they call it in the valley, is that we most likely have glacial till underlying this stuff, but River Creek over the years has migrated back and forth across the valley and reworked that material and taken out a lot of the fines. And so the wells are installed in kind of this more cleaner material, most likely. And then underlying that is possibly just glacial till or bedrock. But we didn't know that. We don't know what, you know, we don't know really what's going on. Don's asking the question of, here's this water coming down here, and what's the water going through into the creek, and how's that water moving? And then one question we still couldn't answer was, how far is it to the bottom of the tub? Because we don't know. We know that this rock is relatively impermeable and the water's coming out this way down the slope, but we don't know where that is. We need to know that so we can sort of model the big picture. So what they're doing with the seismic work is that they use a combination of methods. And the one that you hear the blasting, the horns going off, what they're doing is they're blasting. And simply what they're trying to do is they set a series of what they call geophones across the slope, and they're basically sound sensors, and they set off a charge. Depending on where we are, they may have more than one charge. Let's say just one sound source to make this simple right now. They set up a charge, and the intent, the reason why it's so quiet, you'd think they're blasting off a stick of dynamite, so they put it into the ground, and they cover it up, and all the energy, instead of going out like the big explosions you ever see on TV, what's happening is all the sound's being generated down this way, and this sound wave ends up reflecting off these materials at different depths depending on what the velocities of the materials are. And how fast that wave comes back to these geophones help us to determine what the depth of those materials are. And the velocities are really totally dependent on the density of materials. So we were able to, with that survey, we have a number of service, 8 lines going across the hillside. Each one of those lines will help us to identify what the depth of the bottom of the tub is. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. Number two is, picking out the area where the tails are, because what we're doing right now up in the area of the mill is that what Don was describing about these seeps, we have seeps running below the surface and eventually into Railway Creek. We don't know, if you look at a map on the from an airplane or from the air, we don't know where those flow paths are. We just know that we have seeps are coming out along the creek, but we don't know where they're coming from and how they're migrating through the soil. And what we find is what the water that Don described that has the metals in it has a higher conductivity. It conducts at a higher rate than the water that's clean. And so what they're doing, they're doing what they call an electromagnetic survey. You may see these guys walking with this big wand. What that is that they're picking up subtle changes in the conductivity of the water. And they're able to map, when they're all done, basically the lateral extent of what those seeps are going through the ground. So that's what they're doing with that. And then when we get all done, we're going to have this, you know, this large map that shows depth of bedrock, the surface water, the seep pathways. We'll have the chemistry, we'll have the loading. From all that, we'll have kind of a bigger picture. We'll have a lot better idea what's going on the site.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything else we were supposed to do while we were here, Rick?
I don't know. I think that's pretty much it.
Okay, good.
That explains the field program to this point. To talk about the work in the future, some of us, some of the group that has been here will be back in July for 6 or 8 or 10 days. And what is it they'll... What is it they'll be doing?
Oh, actually, I'll go... You can sit down again.
Excellent.
So anyway, John was saying we've completed the second phase now, and then the next phase is we'll be coming back and taking measurements of the depth of the water again within the wells. We'll be taking another series of measurements within Rio Creek, and this goes back to some hydrology, hydrology 101, and that is, if you look, we all know that in the springtime, water levels rise. And after the middle of summer, the water levels within the creek drop. And if you look at the plot of the flow that Steve was mentioning about what they're measuring in the creek, if you look at the rate over time, this is the flow rate, and this is the middle of winter, and this is the months of May and June, these flow rates just really go way up. And then they come back down again after about the third week of July, then come back to the end of the year, they're really back low again. And what we're trying to do is trying to get the snapshots over time of what this loading is, so we can see whether there are times throughout the year where the loading may be more than other times, if that makes sense. We really want to know, is it all occurring in a short duration, or is it occurring over the whole year? And what we know from experience working on other projects, most of the loading occurs right in this initial spring melt, which is why we were up here running around like crazy just after, in first of all, in April to measure this one. We wanted to capture it. We wanted a snapshot of knowing what the conditions were before this rise. And what we've been doing now is measuring this period right about here. And again, this is not really that smooth, because what it's doing really is going like that, but when you plot it all up, it ends up being kind of relatively smooth. In July, what we're trying to do is we want to come back and capture what happens after the peak. So we're going to come back and take flow, water quality samples, flow measurements, and then water levels again within the tails and the wells to measure this snapshot. And then we come back in September and we do the whole program all over again. You know, I mean, this is the big shift. The big is here. So this is the lowest period. This will be close to the highest. We'll come back and do everything that we're doing now. But most of the seeps are going to be dry by then. I mean, we know that the seeps pretty much dry up. So we'll have mostly surface water, groundwater. And then when the water levels drop, we're going to come back and do a biological survey in the creek. So we don't want people trying to swim out there right now and trying to see what's going on. We're going to be running and looking at the characteristic of the sedimentation that exists, also the population of fish. I mean, there are fish. I mentioned that, yeah, we all know there are fish there. There aren't as many fish here as there are upstream from the mine, and as many fish as there are down Lake Chelan. So we want to kind of map what's going on with the fish population, and also what the fish feed on, the insects. So we'll be mapping that as well, and that'll pretty much finish off the program. And then when we look at the year throughout next. For the winter, we'll be analyzing all this data and then trying to come up, make some sense of all that data, so we can then move on to the next step and figure out what do we do then to take care of the problem. And then what Don was mentioning earlier, what we want to do is really focus on trying to address the major concerns. We don't want to spend all our time on issues that are relatively minor. When you look at a drop in a big bathtub, it's not the concern, but we want to look at the big faucets going in and take care of them. And what we found from the work that USGS completed is that the site overall has two basic types of chemistry. One is the underneath the tails, and that has kind of a high iron, as Don was kind of mentioning earlier, releases iron. And that's binding up the metals. And that's the reason why the water quality is as good within the creek as it is, because the metals aren't free, but what they're doing, they're precipitating in the bottom of the creek and forming that cementation that you see along the creek. But up in the mill area, we have chemistry where there's no iron there available because the tails aren't there. Mm-hmm. And there's higher metals, but again, they're not high enough to cause major concern, but we need to be able to find out, are there primary sources we can kind of shut those valves off and address those issues. So it's kind of a thumbnail sketch of where we're going. Oh, Don, you're on.
No point. Okay. Next on the list is preliminary results. We're getting a little bit short on time. So we're going to have a quick change in schedule here. And blast ahead to potential remedial alternatives, because that's something Rick can talk about. preliminary results that we have gotten, again, we've been out working in the field. There are certain meters that we have had with us, which are those strange instruments we've taken out with us every day. The things that I have seen personally as far as the seeps in the groundwater go tend to reconfirm the data that was collected by the U.S. Geological Survey. There are areas where the water chemistry is not very good in the seeps. I think that's not surprising. I can't think of anything that we have found that is radically different than what has been shown previously.
Over the last year for USGS.
Right. Well, the one thing that I think sort of has taken anybody at all by surprise is hiking further upstream and seeing some of that material that may be coming from Honeymoon Heights. I think that was suspected as being there previously, but it hadn't been really investigated very thoroughly. So, and I know when I first talked with everybody, I tried to come away from this idea that at this time we would be able to tell you how good the water is or how bad the water is. We simply don't know that. Those results are coming back from the lab.
In the next couple weeks.
Okay. So, Rick?
Put me in a hot seat.
That's why you get the big bucks.
For those of you long-term residents, you know that the Forest Service has been working on revegetating the top of the tails. And that's been the reason why, actually I should step back, I didn't go over that, but I'll go real briefly. The two concerns that they were trying to address with that gravel, for those of you who've been here for a long time, you know before 1991, those were big orange piles over there. And what was happening in the afternoon, the winds would pick up, and you get these big clouds of dust going down the valley. So that was one major concern they wanted to address. The other one was the protection along River Creek. So they took care of that by putting big rock along the creek. And they also, there used to be ponds on top of the tails, so they've drained it so the ponds wouldn't form anymore. They put gravel on top to try to prevent the dust. And over the last, actually it's been as long as 30 years, the Forest Service has been involved with trying to look at different types of vegetation that grow on top of the tails. And that's what's going on. You see there's plots going on top of the tails. That's what they're trying to find, is both trees and grasses that will work in a long-term fix. We're going to be looking at that data. We'll be looking at all the data we collected and trying to come up with a remedial option that's going to address the concerns that we've identified, but also what the public will identify. I can't help but emphasize that right now, I hope you don't walk away from this tonight and call up your congressman or call up your Forest Service representative and say, geez, there's all this stuff going on, I really want to know. I'd like to ask you, if at all possible, to walk away this tonight and be patient that we're going to collect the data. The Forest Service, all the agencies will be involved with reviewing the data. Matter of fact, we're having a meeting in July to review even what we're doing now so we can sort of get our arms around what to refine the work that's going on in September. So we want to try to focus that work as much as possible. But we'll have a wide list of remedial options. It's pretty much everyone knows what can or cannot be done. I mean, it's not logical, I don't think, to take all the tails and put them into a landfill down in Wenatchee someplace. So most likely that will be one that the agencies will buy off on. But you know, that there will be, I'm sure some of the public will want to have that done. But we'll have to address all those concerns through the what they call the FS stage, a feasibility study. We'll be addressing all those different remedial options, and then our job is to get a consensus between the agencies and the public and our client to come to an agreement on what the different remedial options are. And Holden Village will be one of the parties that will be involved with that, and you'll be as involved in it as you want to be involved. And when we get to the public involvement stage, you'll be asked to they'll be soliciting input from you on where you'd like to see things go. But what I like to do is wait until the data is done. We'll be able to sort of hopefully summarize it. Like Don was saying, we'll hope our job is to help educate you as the public on helping understand what we're collecting so you can make sense of that what we're doing and hopefully come to the same agreement that we have about the conclusions. But you know, we're not trying to pull any wool over anybody's eyes. We're just going to try to summarize the data into an understandable format so everyone can come to the same conclusions. So that's what we're going to do over the next year. By next spring, we'll hopefully have a list of options that we can then come back in the field again and just look at if we have any data gaps. We'll focus our efforts on just answering some specific questions. But we won't look at a big picture anymore at that point. But at that point, we'll hopefully have some list of ideas we can present to you in a formal format. So what will happen, hopefully in the next week, we'll have, I think within the next week to the next month, we're going to have a formal agreement between the U.S. government, the state of Washington, and Alumat, and the Forest Service on where they want us to go. Right now, we're basically operating under a good faith effort. Our client has given us the resources and to come out and do this work, and all the agencies trust us we're doing this work. There's nothing forcing us to do it. We're not acting under any kind of order to do this right now. So because of it, the negative is the Forest Service can't proceed with the public involvement until the order signed. When the order signed, there'll be a formal process. Right now, again, this is more of an informal discussion, and again, we're willing to answer questions as necessary, but please don't make any phone calls to the people of the Forest Service until we can get our arms around what's going on over the next couple of weeks and we'll get the formal order of calls. So, with that, we can hold up the question and answers?
Yes.
Good. Question and answers. We got 15, 20, 20 minutes before Vespers.
Did you drink the water or did you bring your own?
We drink the water. I mean, the water supply, first of all, the water supply, for those of you that don't know, the water supply doesn't come out of River Creek.
No.
Comes out of Copper Creek, out of diversion, but it's a great, very clean. We know now the very clean water supply. We actually test.
Yes. Why is Alumet willing to fund this project so much and invest so much money if they're not being forced to do anything about it?
Alumet's affiliated with a multinational company, and I think what you're going to find, for those of you involved in environmental issues, I think you're going to find that I think the Bhopal incident, personally, this is my personal opinion, I think the Bhopal incident had more to do with companies changing their perspective on long-term liability than any other single incident that occurred, because they realized they can't just do something without any kind of long-term liability. And the liability in the United States has to do with money, no doubt about it. And I think it's better what the good, smart businesses, the smart industries in the United States now have realized it's better to be proactive than be reactive. If they were reactive, the agencies would be forcing them possibly to do things that, if they were proactive in coming in here, they could actually do it in a series of steps instead of having to do this huge thing all at once. And they know they can do this over the next 2 or 3 years now because they're doing it voluntarily. And they're a lot better off to do it voluntarily and to reduce the long-term liability this way than to be reactive and be forced into an antagonistic relationship. Most antagonistic relationships now don't work out to best interest. The public is way too well informed of what's going on now. 20 years ago, that wasn't the case, but most people now are pretty well informed what's going on. So they felt it's better for them to be proactive now than it is to be reactive. And the reason why we're out in the field is because they don't want to miss, they really would like to take care of the problem sooner than later, because if you owned some liability, and if you owned something that was causing potential liability, you're better off to demonstrate you're taking an aggressive stance to take care of the problem. Because if something does occur later on that, unbeknownst to us, ends up being detrimental, but you just turned a blind eye to it, they'd be more potentially liable than something aggressive. So that's the way they're looking at it. So, also, it could be, from their perspective, I think they think it's just from a public perspective, it's a lot better because, you know, they're not, you know, being looking at being the bad folks. I mean, they really are trying to take care of it. So.
Yes. How does the large amount of snowfall this past winter skew your results?
Actually, it would skew it towards a more conservative, meaning it would actually make the results, if anything, it would make it actually higher concentrations because you're getting more of that flush. So actually, this is a great year for us to be out here. Because I think the concern we would have had is if we would have come out here during a low snowfall, we would have generated this data, the agency would come back and say, whoa, you know, we looked at historically over the snowfall, this isn't, you know, the amount of water coming into the bathtub is a lot less than it could be now. And of course, right now, we've got a pretty much a close to a record, which is really good for us because it helps look at a worst case scenario. That's really what we're trying to capture. That's why we're capturing that four periods. We're looking at the complete spectrum of high concentration or low concentration. What's the variability? It's a really good question. Yes?
I know you didn't want to really talk about specific remediation alternatives right now, but given the fact that most of the small creeks and railroad creek do continue to change their path, is there really any solution that wouldn't involve continuous care of the tailings pile for the next 100, 200 years or so? And as new channels
care in what way? I mean,
so just to make sure that the drainage ditches stay open, that the rock riprap is, you know, secure and so forth, and the Railroad Creek isn't changing its
well, path. And that's where that agreed order comes in. I mean, the when I say that agreed order is basically a contract between U.S. Department, actually Department of Justice who's involved, the U.S. EPA, Ecology, and the Forest Service, all basically by signing on the bottom line, they're committed forever to make sure that the problem is being resolved. So that's the only thing that you can fall back on. I mean, if for example, Alumet, I'm not saying this happened, but say Alumet decided 10 years from now, forget it. Well, based on that agreed order, the U.S. government has total justification to sue them and force them to come back and take care of the problem. And it isn't a Superfund site, but it's still with that order, it forces them to come back and take care of the issues.
More from the geological standpoint, though, not the legal standpoint. I mean, is it the sort of site that will require continuous care?
No, I have no idea. It depends what the remedial options are. I mean, if you were, let's put any ideas in anybody's head, but going back to the idea of, I mean, the absolute best thing that could happen environmentally, if you want to get rid of all the liability, at least on the site now, you would take all the tails and you'd pump the mine full of grout, and you take all the tails and put them underneath a capped landfill someplace, and you try to revegetate the area like it was before the mine was developed. It still wouldn't be the same, but be the closest. You still have the liability associated with the tails being in a landfill. But that's not going to be a reasonable approach. No one's going to want to have 8.5 million tons of tails being carted down the lake, you know. So somewhere between there and what's going on now, right now we know that the tails are overall relatively stable on top, but we have potentially, we'll be coming, I did forget to tell you that in September we'll be also looking at the slope stability. We'll be looking at doing what they call a geotechnical investigation. That's a relatively small step, but we need to look at the slope stability in the long term. But we'll probably have to look at something to stabilize the slopes, whether we increase the protection at the toe, whatever, and if we find that, if you're asking about, like, say, Copper Creek, if we find there's active erosion going on in Copper Creek, we'll have to rectify the problem. I mean, those are issues we have to address. But I guess when you're saying about the other creeks, I guess I'm not sure what you're asking, because of course, the other creeks aren't being affected directly by the mine. The only creek that effectively is being addressed by the mine is Copper Creek.
I was just thinking of small areas of runoff that could open up. But there's a new channel cutting across the garage is right now. Seems like it could always be something that opens up.
Well, but if that is a loading source and that's an erosion source, I mean, that's something we'll have to address. I mean, those are the kind of things that we'll need to address in the remedial alternatives. But, you know, I can't guarantee you, of course, I can't commit for Alumet here as a geologist that for sure that they'll address every erosion problem from here for 200 years from now. But I can tell you that if it's an issue that we find is significant, we'll make sure it's included in the remedial options and we address them as we're going through it. I'm sorry, did I answer your question? I'm not trying to blow you off.
No, I understand. I wasn't really asking from a legal standpoint, though. I'm just, from your experience with other sites of this sort,
We've worked on a lot of mining sites, and yes, I think it is reasonable to assume that you can take care of problems like that, the small, because you can intercept those and try to divert that flow. I mean, that would be a way of taking care of that issue. I mean, is to divert that water so that it's not going directly into Copper Creek or into Railroad Creek. But yes, I think from a perspective of historically, yes, we can address this question.
I mean, the intercept channels up there now are kind of clogged. The geotextile has been torn out.
Right.
I wonder whether those will work long term or whether they'll have to be continuously.
Well, and that's what we'll be addressing as well, because those are issues that we'll need to look at. We can find out how effective have those remedial actions been in 1991 to address the problem we have. I mean, we'll be addressing that for sure.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Yes?
Yes, kind of a tangent on that, Ben, is would this remedial action be, to the best of our knowledge, the final solution?
That's the intent, yes.
Okay.
That's
so
the intent.
50 years from now, lots can change and technology can change and all of that, but we would not forecast that.
Yeah, you can't forecast. The regulations, the way they're written, are that there's no grandfathering in the regulations. Just because you get closure on a site doesn't mean they can't reopen the site later on because the regulations change. You discover later on that one of the metals that you didn't, weren't a metal of concern, let's say iron, for example, ends up being known carcinogen now, even though it's not a carcinogen today, we'd have to go back and address that issue at a later date. So that's something that's order and also the regulations. All the federal and state regulations do not allow grandfathering, basically. They allow reopening in case conditions change.
Are there other sites that are comparable to this, or is this a unique situation?
What's unique about it, from my perspective, having worked on a number of other sites, is that this site is as benign as it is. I mean, it's because they had a really good processing facility, and most of what's in the tails isn't really nasty. The water quality overall is pretty good compared to other sites. If you go into the Silver Valley in Idaho, or like even down in Idaho in the Blackbird mine you're working on now, those sites, they visibly, I mean, everything about them is pretty bad. But this is not, I mean, obviously you're living here. Agencies haven't come in and closed down the site. It's not a Superfund site. It hasn't made the ranking. So it isn't really that bad. That's the only thing that surprises us, that it's basically, and overall, it's not as bad as other sites that we've seen. Matter of fact, it's pretty good, which is actually part of that, I think, the perspective of the client, that I think they felt that it won't hopefully not take a lot of effort to take care of the problems that exist.
There's a lot of organizations with a vested interest here in wanting this to be cleaned up. If Alumet sometime wants to sell, does that stop what remediation might be happening at whatever point in time that would be? Or
they can't sell. I mean, they'll be tied into the order. They can't sell the liability.
Okay, that's what I'm. Okay.
Once they sign the order, they have taken responsibility. They can't sell that. So they are on the hook. Yes, I'm sorry, yes.
I have two questions. One is, have you been keeping records about how much of this ends up in Lake Chelan? Is there any indication?
I went through a real brief, the report we generated in September last year was very, pretty voluminous about emphasizing what's been done historically, and there was a water quality study that was done in 1989 by Patmont through Harper Rose and Crowser and Department of Ecology. They looked at overall, they're trying to establish a baseline within Lake Chelan. And they did a study of water quality and a loading analysis of Railroad Creek into Lake Chelan. Mm-hmm. And looked at sediment studies and water quality and fish tissue studies. And that's pretty much it. But they ended up then coming up to the conclusions of what the impact is of Railroad Creek on the Lake Chelan water quality. What they overall found is that it's pretty insignificant. It does create overall elevated zinc concentrations, but even then, since then, there's some question about some of that data, about the significance of that, because there seems to be a lot more impact from the orchards than there is from Railroad Creek. You know that. The orchards are creating a lot of higher arsenic loading into the lake, and there's no arsenic coming out, there's significant out of Railroad Creek. So.
My other question has to do with the concern, the fish concern, and that is, a lot of that has to do with there's no food that is in the stream.
The macroinvertebrates.
Yeah, has that increased? I mean, we've got many more plants growing up in the tailings, but I don't know anything about.
As far as what the conditions have changed, the last study was done on the fish was done in 1989 by Pacific Northwest Labs, Battelle Northwest. We'll be taking the next snapshot in September. I can't answer until we'll be able to hopefully compare that data and see whether there's any significant changes in the results. At this point, I can't answer that question.
Any